Hi, today's February 20th, 2016. This is Mobile News Podcast number 150, Untitled Gas Aurora, with my good friend John Westfall. And to commemorate this special podcast number, 150, we asked back our good friend Frank McPherson. Sorry, my speech is a little more odd than usual because I've got a bit of a cold and I can't really hear myself. But in any case, yes, before we started the podcast, Frank was telling me about a USB battery he bought. Now, I'm one of those people that gets excited about USB battery chargers, so I was pretty interested in what Frank had to say about this one. So what do you got, Frank? Tell us about what you bought.
Well, what I was in the market for, because I have a Nexus 6P, which uses a USB-C quick charging, is I was looking for an external battery pack that does USB-C quick charging. Mm-hmm. And I came across a article on the RAV Power Turbo Series. This particular external battery has a 20,100 milliamp hour capacity. And what it has four different ports for charging, an in port for standard micro USB charging, but in a Type C port, a Qualcomm quick charging port, and a just a regular 2.4 milliamp or amp port. The Type C does Type C quick charging to the phone. It actually also supports input as Type C. So if I take my 6P charger and plug it in and plug that in the outlet, that will recharge this at quick charging speeds, which is also useful. The of course mentioned the Qualcomm quick charging support, and then the 2.4 amp support works with my Surface 3, which has a micro USB charger for it. It has a different type of more stringent input requirement in order for it to charge. So it's a heavy, you know, this is probably easily a couple of pounds in weight. So you know, it can, if you carry it around with you, it can also be a self-defense weapon. But hey, it's versatile for all the things that I need. And as far as I could tell, it's the only external battery pack that I could find that actually supports quick charging for USB-C. You could probably find a Mophie juice pack, or you know, plug in other chargers that support USB-C. Just for the adapter, and will kind of trickle charge, but won't quick charge. And so this one does. And I did have to get a cable for it. It ships with a micro USB cable, but not a USB-C cable. So I bought an Anker cable that has been certified as compliant to the USB-C charging standards that the Google engineer has been testing.
So you won't kill your computer like some people have done.
Yep, exactly.
Now, when you say quick charge, for a Nexus 6P, for example, if a Nexus 6P is, say, 50%, how fast will it charge it back up?
If it's at 50%, I think you can fully recharge from 50% in probably something like 20 minutes.
Wow, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, it charges pretty quick. Now, it does, you know, it is one of those things where it's like, you know, you ramp up pretty quickly to 90% or 95%, mm-hmm. and it starts slowing down. Right. So that final, you know, top off can take a little bit longer. Right. But, you know, that's the nice thing about the standard, and it's kind of changed things, because the whole idea of topping off your battery is much more effective with this quick charging technology than in whether it's Qualcomm or USB-C, you know, that you can just plug it in and in a matter of 10 or 15 minutes gain back, you know, a noticeable amount. Right. Versus just say a 5% boost of the standard chargers.
Right, that's pretty handy. Especially if you're traveling, or you know, you're a field engineer, or you know, whatever, you're away from a outlet most of the time.
Yeah, I you know, it's, if so far we haven't been able to get the battery technology to the point where we want it to last forever. It seems that the only way, the workarounds, if you will, have been around decreasing how long it takes to recharge the batteries, or is the case of the quick charge, or making it easier to charge like the wireless chargers, right? Wireless, really the benefit is, hey, if I just set it down on a pad, that's convenient, and I'll maybe do it more often, and at least take some of the sting of the having to constantly recharge away.
Well, you know, if Apple would stop making their iPhones thinner and thinner, and at least basically leave the battery the same size, we would have 3-day batteries right now.
Well, yeah, it's a design decision. It's a trade-off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay,
I'm just hoping that eventually we'll get the ZPMs from Stargate that, you know, are basically giant batteries that never go dry, and we can just have a little ZPM on our phones.
There you go. Another Stargate fan. There's not many of us. Next item is something John and I discussed in an earlier podcast, and that's Apple's Error 53 for iOS devices, where if you have your device repaired by a third party and that third party replaces the display, which also is paired with the fingerprint reader, apparently.
It was the home button.
The home button.
Not the display.
Home button. Yeah, if you replace the home button, which is paired, of course, with the fingerprint reader, because that's where the fingerprint reader is, then you break the trust linkage, and Apple decides at this point, well, you've broken our trust, and since we can't trust you anymore, we're just going to turn off your phone and brick it.
Yeah, we have basically said that this was, we could understand Apple's perspective on security, but bricking your phone was a bit extreme, and it looks like Apple basically followed suit with that. Once Error 53 kind of became very popular, there's now a new iOS update, 9.2.1, that you can restore to, that will let you get past Error 53. You probably still won't be able to use your Touch ID sensor, and you probably won't be able to use anything that goes with it like Apple Pay, but it at least will let you use your phone. And then there's a link at the bottom of that page for how to get Touch ID support and service so that you can get it fixed up.
Right. So Apple has an official support page for it. It's HT Hotel Tango 205-628. And I'll put the link in our show notes on mobileviews.com, so you can link to that if you're interested in it. Next up is another one, which I found, I'm not sure what I'm to think about it. So, you know, in the U.S., the cellular phone carriers have been subsidizing phones for years. So, you know, you can buy an $800 phone for $200 to $400, and then essentially you're in a two-year contract where you pay the phone off invisibly through your thing. Well, most of them have gotten rid of that, so there's no more subsidies, I guess. Depends how you look at it. But now Apple has a trade-up installment program which lets you get rid of your old phone or trade in your old phone to get a new model for just under $35 a month for 2 years. Now, if you do the math, that's still a lot of money. That's, you know, $800, essentially.
$840.
Yeah. Which is what you would pay for a new phone anyway, but you don't have to pay for it all at once.
Yeah, but that seems a lot more than just your base model iPhone cost.
Yeah, that's a big 6 Plus, a 6P rather.
Yeah, this is not going to be Apple, out of the goodness of their heart, giving you 0% financing. No. You are paying an interest rate on this. So it still is better if you can buy your device all at once, but if you can't, if you don't have that kind of purchasing flexibility, then this is just as good as any other option that allows you to pay off over time. I guess I would be, if I was in this situation, I'd be much more likely to probably go with Apple than the OEMs, because I hate trusting the OEMs with anything, so just out of prejudice, I would probably not go with Verizon or T-Mobile or Sprint or AT&T, but it's nice to have options.
Yeah,
it's
another good option. That's how Google Fi handles it. So if you buy one of their supported phones, and it's only two, there's there was a 6, which is what I have. There's a 6P, which Frank uses, and a 5X. You can pay monthly, which basically splits the cost by 24, with no interest. So, you know, Google Fi does that also, and has done it from the beginning, which was last spring. Now, another item that I found kind of interesting is, it's probably a limited kind of interesting, but Skype finally, and this is important to me, Skype finally put into production the group video calling for mobile phones and tablets. Until now, you could join a Skype call of more than two people, but if you were on a smartphone or tablet, you could only join the voice call part. You couldn't actually join the video call. They had put in preview mode, which I could never get working, I think last year, and they finally went live with it. So apparently, you can now use your iPad or Android tablet or Android phone or whatever to join a group video call, which would have been handy because John and I have had a couple places where we had some guests who weren't able to use or get to a desktop for some reason. They were coming in via Skype, but we couldn't see them because...
This is also something I think is going to, we've been wondering for a while when FaceTime is going to get group video calling, and this is something I think Apple can't ignore. If Skype finally can do group video calling and Google Hangouts can do group video calling, I would think that FaceTime group video calling should be on the horizon in the near future.
And Hangouts, Google Hangouts has been able to do it from the beginning, from several years ago. Now, that said, I had a Hangout chat video call. Actually, it was a work call with a person in Washington, D.C. the other day, and we had lots of problems with Hangouts. So it was interesting. I was kind of testing that as a possible alternative to using Skype, which is what we use to record these podcasts. But for now, I guess we'll skip it with Skype because Google Hangouts has its own set of reliability issues.
I have never had Google Hangouts work properly for me. It seems every time I've used Google Hangouts, I've had some strange issue. And it keeps making me think it should work because it's obviously a very popular service and Google, pushes it. But it always seems like there's some strangeness to it whenever I try to use it.
Is Frank, do you Skype much aside from talking to me and John?
No, not really. I don't actually use – I have one other friend of mine who actually we use Google Hangouts.
And Google Hangouts.
And that tends to be just voice only, not video to communicate. But I guess I'm kind of boring in that way. But the thing I was wondering about as you guys were talking is that Skype has been around much longer than FaceTime. Mm-hmm. And I got to imagine a lot of people who use FaceTime today used Skype once before and probably have relatives or friends that are on Skype still today. I just wonder if a feature like this would get somebody to use FaceTime less or stop using it altogether in favor of just going Skype. I don't use FaceTime myself, so I don't know whether, it's from a feature standpoint is that much better that it would really keep people, compel somebody to stick with it.
Yeah. FaceTime has never quite achieved the widespread use that we thought it might. For one, Apple said at one point they were going to open it up. I think this is before it actually launched. And that other platforms supported, but nothing except Apple devices supports it. So if you're in a Windows box or a Linux box or Android or whatever, you can't FaceTime as far as I know. I mean, maybe there's some kind of third-party bridge, but, it's not an official Apple-supported thing. And, like you said, it doesn't do group calling. Now, the one thing it does have is if you are an all-Apple friend group or family or whatever, it is incredibly easy to FaceTime because you just call the person just like, you would call them for a voice call. It's the same phone number and all of that. So it is much simpler than Skype if you know that person's phone number.
Yeah, it's an integration versus feature trade-off. If you are a heavy FaceTime user, but you see Skype introduces this feature, if you want this feature, you'll probably give up the integration of FaceTime in the OS and go with the third-party Skype software, which is, Skype on iOS has gotten a little better. The UI is still kind of weird, and notifications are still hit and miss.
Yeah, and I still have concerns about how it hits the battery. It's gotten better over time, but initially I know it killed my battery, so I had to uninstall Skype. And just sitting there, it would kill my battery, not making any calls.
Yeah, I haven't had that problem with Skype on my iOS devices, so maybe they just didn't like you, Todd.
Now, a short item is a googly item, and that's I noticed that Google announced in their Cloud Platform blog that they have a beta release of their Google Cloud Vision API. Which is kind of cool. So you can now use the API Google uses to recognize objects. If you want to try to write something that does image recognition or object recognition in images, I guess I should say. So, you know, that's a lot of heavy lifting for most people, unless you happen to be an AI specialist in object recognition. So that's pretty cool that the masses of programmers now have a vetted API for object recognition in an image.
I agree. I just don't have any use for it right now. But it does sound like a very cool API to have access to.
It's one of those things very cool, and unless you have a specific... But I just found it very interesting. I think Google...
I'm going to build an app for my professor friends called Student Cheater Detector. You just put a webcam on your class, and then it just takes pictures every couple of seconds and runs them through Google Cloud API for students talking to each other, or crib notes, or... We wandering eyes, you can probably with a high resolution image do most of that. So
that sounds very NSA-ish to me, or even NRO-ish.
Someone has to give the NSA a run for their money.
Okay, and one more short item before we get to the what I think will be a long discussion with John and Frank is I wrote an article for ExtremeTech.com that Outlook.com, the web-based version of Outlook, got a major facelift. I don't have it, but it added a whole bunch of new features, including the support for third-party add-ins like Evernote and I think Yelp and Uber and a bunch of other things. The gotcha is the way Microsoft is rolling this out across, it used to be called Hotmail, right? They're rolling across what the old Hotmail is that it's doing it, by groups of users, and I'm not one of them. I still have the old interface. Apparently, if you create a new account, you'll get it right away, but that's sort of useless because nobody's going to email you to a brand new account, so I'm not going to even bother doing that just to see what it looks like. But it does sound kind of interesting. It sounds like they're catching up to Google Mail, to Gmail, and adding a few things like add-ins that from major third parties. I don't know if Gmail – I know Gmail has add-ins, but they tend to be Google Laboratory stuff. So that should be kind of interesting, I think.
So Todd, you mentioned email and Google.
Yeah.
There's one other thing that Google announced this week that your listeners may be interested in. They announced this on the official Gmail blog, something they're calling Gmailify.
Oh,
basically, people today have the ability to set up Yahoo and Outlook so that you could access that email in Gmail.
Mm-hmm.
But you're just basically... it's just basically a POP3 client or an IMAP client. You're just getting access to the email.
Yeah.
What Google has done is they've incorporated those accounts into Gmail in such a way that you can now also get the spam protection that Gmail provides and the inbox organization. It's basically another step towards that unified inbox. And the other interesting feature here is also incorporation into the Google Now cards. So if you have an account, say, an Outlook.com account, and you pull it into Gmail, if there is a travel itinerary or something coming in through that account, apparently Google Now will now see that as part of that and incorporate it into the Google Now cards, which looks kind of interesting. So I think that's, like I said, that's out on their blog at gmailblog.blogspot.com. And I haven't had a chance to go through it in detail as to how you enable it, but I'm sure it's a setting that you enable on that account.
Yeah, two comments about that. One, that the ability for Gmail, without Gmailify, but Gmail in general, to be able to receive, for example, airline itineraries and integrate it into Google Now is just awesome. I frequently need to go, synchronize with my daughter who's in college and is traveling around. She's in the United Kingdom right now for this semester. And so I tell her, if you're going to meet me somewhere, by meet me, fly in somewhere, like we're going to meet in Edinburgh, Scotland in April, email me your itinerary and Gmail will just add everything to my Google Now. So, I will see where your plane is on that day, even if I forget to put in a calendar for some reason. And it's just awesome. Or, if my wife goes on a business trip and I need to pick her up, I just tell her, just send me your itinerary. That way I don't even have to put in a calendar. Google will tell me when I need to start driving out to the airport to pick you up. Very handy. The other thing, which is more of a rant, and I'm kind of taking on John's job here for a minute. But, one of my rants is on iOS and Android, Gmail, I think, I need to think about this. Okay, I know Gmail on Android for sure. I don't know about Gmail on iOS. Gmail on Android can handle IMAP 4 accounts just fine. So if you have an IMAP 4 email account somewhere, it is great. And believe me, if you have a choice between IMAP 4 and POP 3, you do not want to use POP 3. That is bad news. You just can't manage your email that way. However, Gmail in the browser, which for all intents and purposes is Gmail on your desktop or notebook, cannot handle IMAP 4. It can only handle POP 3, which drives me nuts because I would like to fold all of my IMAP 4 accounts, and I have several, and I have, I don't know, maybe four or five, I think, actually. Four IMAP 4 accounts, I'd like to fold them all into Gmail and have Gmail handle spam and all of that, but I can't do it because it only does POP 3. Anyway, that's my rant. I hope Google puts in IMAP 4 support in Gmail browser version someday soon, because they already support it on Android. So I don't know what the hang-up is. How do you guys handle your IMAP 4? What client do you use on your mobile device? None? You have nothing, Frank?
For IMAP, I just use Inbox.
Okay.
I use Gmail for everything.
Okay.
I don't, you know, I have email. I have email accounts like with Yahoo and Outlook.com, and they're not really used for a whole heck of a lot. Yeah, so I don't really access them very much. I used to, way back in the day, have a POP3 account. And I still have it, and I set it up to forward to my Gmail.
Yeah.
So I never really go in and get it anymore.
How do you manage the POP3? Do you just have it delete after it forwards?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, I guess that's one way to do it. Maybe I should just do that and be done with it. And how about you, John? What do you use? You just use a stock iOS mail client?
Yeah, really. Well, I was using the stock iOS mail app for a long time. I actually switched my devices over about this week was the last device I switched over fully. So all my iOS devices are now using Outlook.
Oh, that's interesting.
Which I found I really like the focused inbox. Yeah. I really like the way it can integrate everything. Plus, it gives me push Gmail back to my iOS device.
Yeah.
That client will support it because the built-in iOS mail client does not support the IMAP REST API. So I've been using that, and I've been pretty happy with it. I can do my email pretty quick. I actually find one of the reasons I never really took off to the iOS Gmail client, even though I do have it on my device, is it's way too slow compared to many other mail clients.
Now, Frank, are you still using Google's Inbox app on your Android device? And you're still happy
yes.
with it?
Yeah, it's the only one I use. I use Inbox on desktop, on my phones, tablets. It's, you know, other than, even, you know, on my Surface, though I tend to use the built-in Windows 10 mail app, because it's kind of that unified inbox, if you will. But very often, I'm so used to the way Inbox organizes things. You know, it takes the promo emails and the updates and all groups them together, and I just quickly triage. I'll open, expand up all the updates. I'll scan through anything, look at the things I want to read. Otherwise, just clear them all right away, and I'm done with them. And I just gotten very used to it.
Okay. Now, the next one probably in more than a few, but I think Sean had a few things to say about. Most of you have probably been reading all the pros and cons and rants and raves about Apple, Google, and I guess Microsoft and a few others have joined the opinion that they will not put in a backdoor on their systems for law enforcement to use. And specifically, they've been asked to, Apple has been asked specifically by the FBI, which means the U.S. Justice Department, to look into the phone, which is an Apple iPhone 5C, to unlock it.
Well, that's not exactly what they were asked.
Well, not unlock it, but to get access to it.
Well, they were asked to, so the FBI asked Apple to build a custom version of iOS that could be flashed onto the phone that would disable the interval between PIN code attempts. It would allow the PIN code to be entered electronically through the USB connection.
More than 10 times.
It would disable the 10 times.
No, they wouldn't unlock it.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah. What I I'm emphasizing here is that they're not asking, they're not going to hand the device to Apple and say, here, unlock this and give it back to us.
Right.
They would like Apple to create a solution that could be potentially used in future
which situations. Is a backdoor. Yeah.
Yeah, at their discretion. And right. they would hold that backdoor.
So there's a lot of technical pros and cons and discussions going on. I happen to think that the Electronic Frontier Foundation has a really good overview of the whys and wherefores and whats of this particular thing that certainly I don't feel technically competent to do, discuss in any detail, except to say that I think backdoors in general are bad. Even for something like this, where you know you definitely would like to see the contents of this phone by unlocking it, in general, the idea of being able to unlock any phone essentially in the future is something that is of concern to me. I don't know how you guys feel about it.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and this is, I think, I'm hoping that is part of this, that we have a real honest and serious debate about encryption and our rights and how we view things going forward, because encryption is vital to our ability to continue using the internet in a way that is secure. Identity theft is a huge issue. And in my way of thinking, the only possible way we can prevent against identity theft is encryption, and encryption in such a way that it works effectively. No backdoors. Only I can, you know, decrypt the information or the people I designate can decrypt it. And if I actually forget that key, I lose that information. That's the risk.
Right.
But it has to be that secure, or our ability to use the internet, and really, it isn't even the internet. There's almost nothing about us today that doesn't touch the computer. Right. Our social security numbers, our health information, that is all has to be encrypted. And as long as we're just going to be a number, and that's what we are, that's our identity on networks and on computers is a number, and that can be easily copied. So we need a secure way to do that. And we're in a point in time now where mathematically we can make data secure so nobody can get at it. And that's fundamentally something that's different. But like guns, like the Second Amendment, encryption can be used for good by good people to do the types of things that we wanted to do to secure our bank accounts and everything. But it can also be used by bad people to do bad things.
Right.
And so, like we have this debate about gun laws and whether or not everybody should have guns and an amendment that protects that, I think we need a similar discussion. I would go as far as to say this might be a time where we should seriously think about some type of amendment to the Constitution, because this gets into an area I don't think the founders ever conceived of. And it kind of gets into this question of rights, and just like, again, like I said, a gun law of a right that can be used for good or bad, that in it, you know, says, okay, in the end, instead of taking it all away from people, you know, good people can have a right to doing it. I think we're going to want to, we should think about encryption in the same way, because when you hear the debates coming from like the FBI and all that, they have fears, and I think some of it's legitimate, of how encryption can impede in their ability to do their job. And one could basically say, and we're in a society now that says security is prime. It's the most important thing. And in that type of culture and security conscious, I think we get a lot of people to just quickly say, okay, do whatever you need to do. And I think that's a scary situation if we just willingly giving up our rights for the sake of security.
That's interesting. And you know, encryption is not something new. I mean, I think people tend to think of encryption only in terms of digital gadgets and electronics and digital transmission. But it's as old as civilization. I mean, the ancient Romans used, you know, simple kinds of rotation encryption to send coded messages. And of course, you know, back in World War II, the what was Alan Turing and his team at Bletchley Park in England broke the Nazis' encryption code. What was it called? John, do you remember, Frank?
The Enigma.
Enigma. Yeah, the Enigma machine. So, I mean, you know, and that that made a difference in the whole war. So certainly encryption is not something new, and although the Founding Fathers didn't discuss it in the Constitution, you're right, Frank. And it might be worth discussing.
So I agree with everything Frank said. One of the things about encryption that I think often gets overlooked by common everyday folks who think about it is that if you ask, I'd be willing to bet if you ask most people, do you use encryption on your phone or computer? They would say no, even though every SSL website they go to is using encryption. Mm-hmm. Most of their hard drives, if they've turned on File Vault or BitLocker, they're using encryption. They might not even realize it. It's almost that since they don't see a matrix-like screen show up whenever they put their password in and all the buttons align and the numbers, you know, click into place and, man, now I've been able to see all this data because I decrypted, they just assume that they've never used encryption and that, okay, well, if I don't have to use it for my daily life, then no one should have to use it. So the government should be able to break into it whenever they need to, because obviously only the bad guys are using it.
Yeah, I think public perception is one of the things, or public education is one of the things that's much needed. And, you know, well, I don't know who's going to be doing the education, but it'll be interesting to see. And I think folks like the Electronic Frontier Foundation and other organizations of, you know, who are well trusted and that sort of thing will need to get into this game and start talking about it from a wider perspective than just, you know, geeks like us.
Yeah. So do you want me to go on my geeky rant
now? Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So there's a couple of interesting things about the case with the San Bernardino shooter that hit this week. There's some, you know, this and that. Apple released a statement a few days ago basically saying that the FBI screwed it up themselves by changing the iCloud password, and if they hadn't, they wouldn't have had this problem. Mm. And, you know, there's just a bunch of this and that and little details that are coming in and out. But the detail that I think a lot of people are overlooking is that this was not – so the shooter had a personal phone that he destroyed physically before he carried out the attack. And so, you know, you would think that that's probably where most of the information the FBI would like to have was at. This was his work iPhone that they have. Now, mm-hmm. he happened to work for San Bernardino County, right, which meant that this was a device that the IT gurus in San Bernardino County had to set up for him, or at least in some way allow him access to their network with. Now, a lot of people probably don't think about this because they don't really know about how mobile devices are set up by companies, but there is a whole suite of tools that Apple makes available for cheap or free. I mean, the server app costs $20, and the Apple Configurator app is free, that allow you to what Apple refers to as put an iPhone into supervised mode, which basically says you can configure it to lock down most of the operating system, prevent configuration changes, prevent a lot of different things. And the two important ones, you can prevent someone from wiping the phone so they can't wipe it and then reset it up the way they want it. And you can remotely unlock the phone. You can remotely clear the passcode. So one would think, and this is something I got very frustrated about on my blog. I put a blog post up the night that this really hit. I haven't seen a single media source talk about this, because one would think if this is a government-owned iPhone that they should be able to clear the passcode, and if they can't, it wasn't set up properly in the first place.
You blame the county.
And you touch on an interesting part of all this, too, that people – you know, don't understand. Mark Cuban wrote, a really good blog post about this topic as well. And he points out that, you know, there's no guarantees that there's any information on this phone that is of use to the FBI or anybody. You know, so the risks, in like you just said, John, the likelihood is there isn't anything. If you have a company-owned phone, I have one, and I naturally assume that my company, my employer, has access to everything I put on that phone. It's you know, it's theirs. It's their property. Reasonable. I'm not going to put anything personal on that device.
And you're not a terrorist.
Exactly.
Yeah. So one would think if you are using electronic devices to plan and commit dastardly deeds, you're definitely going to be thinking about someone else owns this. I probably shouldn't use it for anything that they would want that data from because they could access it.
Definitely.
So yeah, my rant was just on that level. I think what got me most annoyed was no one mentioned that the county should have this ability. And it just appears to me in general that these tools aren't used very often. I don't know of any company that actually takes the time to configure iPhones or takes the time to manage iPhones using these tools, even though they are available for free.
Yeah. It sounds like we should invite Don Sorcellini back, our mobile enterprise expert, and see what he says about this sort of thing. He probably deals with
that. That is true.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll yeah, and I think I came across there's a BuzzFeed article that talks about the issue with the iCloud ID and password, and I think that is an interesting piece of information. It at least makes you kind of scratch your head. The point of it is that one way that the FBI could have gotten at the information they're looking for is to basically connect a device to a known Wi-Fi network and enforce it to initiate an iCloud backup. And it's so long as that the ID and the password on the device is the same as what's on the server from a previous backup, you can force that backup to occur and back up the whole device. And, of course, then once it's on the iCloud server, then the FBI can get to the information. In fact, they've already gotten some of the prior information. They've gotten the prior backups. The article that came out on Saturday, and somebody from San Bernardino County tweeted this, is that the password was changed by somebody at the county, and they basically said the FBI was part of that process.
Yeah.
So either somebody made a mistake and caused that password change, or somebody intentionally changed that password. And if they did that, somebody should ask the question of why. And it kind of goes to
and who?
What's really going on here? Yeah. You know, really, we know that the director of the FBI has been hammering at Apple for their plans to fully encrypt the device, the newest devices, make them inaccessible to law enforcement, and he's not very happy about that. So the conspiracy theorist-eyed angle to this would be that this is just something the FBI has seized the moment. This is a terrorist attack. It's emotional. A lot of people in our country are, you know, will be very supportive of law enforcement and fighting terrorism, and so this is their chance to basically, you know, build their case against Apple. And I do think that this is just the beginning of something larger. It's not just about accessing this device. It's about trying to change some things that Apple has been doing.
Yeah.
I think you're exactly right. I don't even think it's a conspiracy theory. I think it's pretty clear that mistakes were made and the FBI sees this as an opportunity to use this particular situation to try to get a precedent for a much larger sort of change in the way that the government is able to access this information. So I give a lot of credit to Apple and to the other people who are standing with Apple for standing up at this point and saying, this is not like every other information request we've ever gotten. They are trying something different here, and it's much more dangerous than what has been tried before.
And if it becomes a broader encryption thing, just beyond this one specific thing that John gave some details to of what they want to do, which is different from other encryption problems, but your financial transactions and everything will be at risk at that point.
Right. And there's a big issue from Apple's point of view on this at a number of different layers. I mean, first of all, Apple has been very much positioning themselves as we're the company concerned about your privacy and your security, as opposed to Google, where Android's much more open, it's less secure. Mm. You can trust that if you buy an iOS device, it's going to have the best security. One could claim that's already been damaged by news that the fact that somebody can get into a locked phone. I mean, I was a little bit surprised when I heard, hey, they can just connect it to a USB cable and be able to come up with a way to bypass that lock. You would think that that would be something that would be prohibitive. In this very old law It's like, I think, from the 1789 or something.
I heard about that.
Law that allows the government to compel a third party to assist them has a clause in it that says it cannot cause undue burden to the third party.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know how you cannot make the case that forcing a company to directly go against what it's been marketing itself as an undue burden for starters. Not to mention the amount of engineering work that's going to have to go
to compromise its security. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the other interesting thing about this is that Apple is the only company that sells iOS devices. There's no other, unlike Android, you can't buy another manufacturer who makes that. Mm-hmm. And so there's got to be measures put in place to prevent somebody from getting a hold of that code and putting it on another phone. And that's tied very deeply, I would think, to these IDs and this secure ID, which is why Apple's got to do this in the first place as opposed to the FBI. If a third party can get their hands on effectively making their own version of iOS and starting putting it on other phones, from Apple's perspective, that's one of the worst things that could happen to it. I would think if you combine all those things, I think that's undue burden. I don't know how the government can compel them to do this, but I'm not a lawyer. I'm just a
neither am
I'm
I.
Just a geek. But that part of it's interesting as well.
Yes. The other thing that I thought was very interesting as we were talking about this is just if we do set a precedent that encrypted communications can be tampered with, many of the things that the government and the Justice Department likes about technology, the fact that it can track you in many ways and it can be used to establish, that an individual set up, for example, a financial transaction, that could all go out the window with a defense attorney going, well, we know that encryption is no longer viable, so how can you prove that it was actually my client who initiated that transaction? Mm-hmm. Someone could have spoofed the encryption and made that transaction on his behalf or made that transaction without his knowledge.
Because we know there's a back door now. So
yeah, we know there's a back door, so we know that it's not secure anymore. So in the end, this might actually, if the worst case scenario happened for privacy, it might also be the worst case scenario for prosecution of criminals.
Yeah, because what's going to actually happen through all this, if you think about this, if you're somebody really concerned about securing your information, you basically are now got evidence that says, I probably can't trust Apple.
Yep.
I probably can't trust Google.
Yep.
The only thing that I can trust, if I'm really smart, is myself, which means if I'm really smart, I write my own code that does it. But at the very least, I deal with some other third party. Hopefully multiple third parties, they can produce the same thing that I could put on my phone so that even if I bypass the lock code and I get on the phone, it's encrypted in such a way that nobody's going to get to it. And Apple or Google or anybody, Samsung, can't be compelled to actually turn over that information. That's what's probably likely going to happen. And that's almost the worst thing that could happen is if you're the FBI or any other law enforcement.
Yeah. Yeah. To basically allow a situation where people go, guess I have to roll my own. I guess I have to, start finding, encryption sources that I can use that I trust. Yeah. That's the worst thing that they could get. But, I really hope that calmer legal heads look at this, and I'm sure Apple is putting together a very strong case right now in their formal protest. And hopefully in the next couple of weeks we'll find some closure to this that isn't Apple has to create a hacked version of iOS.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if a guerrilla encryption system emerges because of all of this. We saw things like it in the past, a PGP and that sort of thing. But in any case, on that happy note, I will bring Mobley's podcast number 150 to an end. I want to
hopefully 250 will show up eventually. In the future, we won't be shut down.
Exactly. I want to thank our special guest Frank McPherson for joining us on this. Special in terms of number, I guess. I guess not special in other senses, but it's special to me. It's 150. I didn't really think this podcast would be going on this long. And of course, thanks to John for hanging in there week after week, talking to me.
Anyone who will listen to my crazy wild rants and not call me completely off my rocker, I'm happy about that.
Okay. So, okay, 150 is in the can. We will talk to you next time.